Broadcasting worldwide on internet radio.
Refreshing takes on legal strategies.
Straightforward answers to difficult tax questions.
Independent ideas on building wealth. The Refresher Wealth Show with Mark Kohler and Matt Sorensen.
Previously recorded with Mark as the host of The Mark Kohler Show.
Enjoy this fresh take on strategies to better live the American dream.
Everybody to today's show. Oh boy, there was a little glitch there. Sorry about that, folks. Welcome to today's show. This is yours truly, Mark Kohler. Another amazing hour here trying to hold things together with the American dream. And excited to be with you. It's tax season. It's tax awareness month, as they say. So I want to bring you up to speed on any little points and deadlines that you might be facing now. And for those that are listening to this show via podcast after the fact, welcome. I know you might be running on the treadmill or just in the evening working out on your desk to return some emails. Glad to have you here. We're excited about today's show. This is going to be a great show. Got Bruce Norris, infamous Bruce Norris, on the show with us today. He is an urban legend here in Southern California, and all over the country, I should say. He's an expert when it comes to real estate forecast models and also hard money and basic real estate strategies. So we're excited to have him on the show today. It's been a long time in the coming. I've really wanted to have him here. So we're excited to have him join us here closer to the bottom of the hour. And I think you'll all find it extremely rewarding. So you're going to want a pad of paper handy, I'm sure, take a few notes. But it is, like I said, tax season. So we need to talk about tax tips and legal tips and just kind of share some of the experiences that we've had in our offices over the past week and maybe share a little something that could help you better protect your assets, save taxes, and just basically better live the American dream. I wanted to mention my my little newsletter tip or topic that I shared today. I hope all of you are getting my newsletter every Tuesday morning. I try to send it out at midnight on Tuesday morning. My wife knows I stay up late every Monday night working on articles and bringing it all together, and then boom, hit send it. 12:01 and hit the sack. So that's kind of the, if you want to know where I'm at on Monday nights, you can text me and you'll know where I'm at. But I, one of the thoughts I shared in my weekly message was just the dedication and determination it takes in small business to just finish the projects, work hard and not give up. And it's hard, you know, when everything seems to be, you know, conspiring against you, and the business, you know, whether it's vendors or customers or employees or sales are down, and you're doing everything you think you should be, and it just doesn't seem to be clicking. I want to encourage you, stick with it. There's clients and customers I meet every day that are just killing it and making money hand over fist, and others that are in a downswing and they're struggling and frustrated. And then 6 months from now, they're the ones up and the others are down. It's a roller coaster ride, folks. If you haven't been an entrepreneur all your life, embrace this. Buckle up. This is normal. So stick with it. Now, there's going to be times, of course, where you need to, you know, cut bait, pull out the little scissors and cut the line and let it go. You're not going to untangle that line. And it's sometimes you're hitting your head against the wall for a business idea that isn't going to work. And that certainly can be the case. But stick with it. Get a second opinion. Talk to your advisors, your team of managers, your professionals, your friends, your family. Do surveys with your customers, your vendors, those around you, and try to get a good sense of if what you're trying to accomplish, there is a market for it, if your pricing is right, if your product is attractive to the buyer, and maybe something does need to be changed, but sometimes it just means you gotta stick it out. So want to just give that little rah 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 and wish you all the best out there and encourage you not to give up. And with that said, I'm going to bring out our first little expert for the day and a regular contributor to the show, Jaron Bergeson. He's an attorney in our office, licensed in 3 states, but nonetheless helping clients all over the country with their business planning and writing some nasty letters here and there. He just had a big win in court recently, and he's also he's getting pretty good with taxes and numbers. So we're really impressed with him and lucky to have him a part of the firm. Jaron runs our Utah office. And Jaron, welcome to the show.
Good to be here, Mark.
How are you doing today? Hanging in there?
We're freezing up here. It's about 25 degrees and about 25-mile-an-hour wind. It's pretty nasty up here in Cedar City, Utah today.
Wow. Well, I won't mention that I was thinking of doing my show outside and getting a little tan during the show, so but I guess I did just mention that. So anyway, I'll...
Yeah. Thanks. Thanks a lot.
Sorry about that. Sorry. But it's so cozy, though. You can, you know, go to Starbucks and get your favorite drink and snuggle up, you know, somewhere tonight. Isn't that sound exciting to you?
Not okay, as exciting anyway, as being in Southern California. No. No, it doesn't.
All right. Well, hey, Jaron, what do you got for us this week? What have you experienced with a client this week that you might be able to share? Of course, keeping things confidential, but as you always do. But what do you got for us that might help us, our other listeners out?
Well, I talked to a new client that was referred to us actually today. This morning, I talked to this client, and he has a situation where he and his father ran a consulting kind of business that was incorporated as an S corporation that his dad was the 100% owner of, but that he was an officer, the son was, and a director and worked in the business as well. Well, unfortunately, this client's father passed away recently, and the ownership interest was held 100% by his father in his father's personal name. And he was calling us trying to figure out how to structure this. How can I move these shares into my name now? You know, it was supposed to go to me. Dad always wanted it to go to me, but it didn't get done before Dad passed away. I had to tell him at this point, if the ownership, if the company wasn't owned in the name of a trust, and there's not anything specific in a will, then, you know, this is going to have to go through probate, and if there was no will, you may not end up getting the entire share of the company. It may be split among multiple people. So, you know, it just goes to show that you never know when you know, your ultimate demise is going to come. It's going to come for all of us at some time, and there are ways to plan for this so that your heirs aren't going through the issues that he's going through.
Yeah, it's probably a shock when he maybe even was working in the business and thought his siblings wouldn't have any claim to the asset or the business, and it sounds like he might have to cut them in the action. This is a really good point that brings up the family farm, the family cabin, the family business. Mom and dads, ironically, especially dads, don't want to address the inheritance issue. They just kind of ignore it. It's kind of a scary thing.
Absolutely. And, you know, as you know, if they had done an estate plan and if this S corporation interests were owned in the name of a revocable living trust, then that trust could have directed what to do upon his passing. You know, there were lots of things that they could have done. At least a will would have directed where that company interest is to go. But it doesn't look like this father had any of those. So there's probably going to be some probate filings, and it's going to be a while till all this is sorted out.
Well, you know, and I want to just mention one thing for those older business owners, men or women listening to the show. Let me just mention a couple things so that you don't feel this is daunting. Bare minimum, let me just make a recommendation. Bare minimum, this weekend, pull out a clean, fresh piece of paper and sit down and do a handwritten will. Just say, here's where I'd like my business to go. Here's where I'd like the farm to go, or the cabin, or the beach house, or the assets, the money, the real estate, whatever it is. Write it down. And even if a will has to be probated, at least the family's going to know what your wishes were. Get it witnessed. We always recommend you with a handwritten will, a couple witnesses, and if you can, get it notarized. But even if you don't get it notarized or witnessed, write it out. Fax us a copy. We'll put it in your file. There's no charge, of course, for that, just to put it in your file. But heaven forbid, at least you've got something there. I mean, Jeremy, it doesn't have to be that difficult, does it?
No, absolutely. You can handwrite a will and sign it. In most states, that'll be acceptable. It's certainly better than nothing. It's at least an expression of what you wanted to have done with your assets when you pass away. If you don't have some sort of expression like that of what you wanted to do, be it through a will or a trust or something you write on a piece of paper, then there are state statutes that are going to decide for you where your assets are going to go. The intestacy statutes, they're called. And most people don't want that to happen. Most people don't want the government telling them where their assets are supposed to go, even when they're gone. It can be avoided. We have more sophisticated ways to avoid that through an estate plan with us, but something is certainly better than nothing.
Yeah, well, I can't agree more, and I'm grateful that you brought up this topic. And one last point for all those business owners out there, if you do go to the next level of getting a family trust done, it can be very, very affordable. We don't charge more than $1,200. That's it. That's our highest price for a married couple. Single, of course, are going to be less. But once you get a trust done, you can easily do a one-page or two-page amendment as things change. So, again, folks, don't think it has to be in stone. You know, if one of your kids really ticks you off, you can cut them out, put in someone else. Do whatever, But just do something. That's an important point. So, well, yep. Jerem, thanks so much for joining the show. And people want to get a hold of you and work on a little bit of an estate plan with you. How do they reach you?
They can give us a call here. It's 435-586-9366, or they can send me an email. My first name, JAROM, as in Mary, at kkoslawyers.com.
And I think you're suggesting do not come visit at least this week. Maybe.
Don't. It's going to be gorgeous in 2 days, but don't come today or tomorrow.
Yeah, 25 degrees and 25-mile-an-hour wind. So, wow, well, fun. We'll enjoy that up there. And, Jeremy, thanks again for joining us on the show, and we'll catch you in a few more weeks when you come back.
Sounds good, Mark. Thanks.
Thank you. Okay, now, folks, if you've just joined us, we're going through the first part of our show, as usual, with a few little tips that might help you in your current business operations, tax and legal. And then we're going to be joined by Bruce Norris here, national expert on real estate forecast models and hard money lending. We're excited to have him join the show. We'll be with him and just shortly. Now, I wanted to cover a little tax tip. Now, my team, and I want to say this, this little operation of Kohler & Ayer CPAs and KQS lawyers, and many of you see my emails and newsletters and blogs and videos, none of this could happen without my incredible team back in the office. And I'm just so impressed with the dedication, the intelligence and quality and hard work of my team. And I say that because they're all just back cranking away in our home office in Cedar City. We've got, of course, offices in Phoenix and Irvine. I'm not taking away from those folks. But our accounting team right now, they're in the heat of it. So the heat of battle of tax season. So I wanted to just thank them for all the hard work they're doing. And so I get the honor of doing a little tax tip. My managers and partners are all just swamped and said, Mark, please, can we not join one of us, not join the show today and give a tip? So if we could, I'll cover that myself. So I want to hit something that I think is very important. There's a couple. Okay, April 15th is right around the corner. So for those that are listening to this live, and hopefully within the next week, You will certainly be the benefactors of this point that I want to make, because we're coming up on April 15th. Now, there's a few filing. Now, this is important, so everyone listen up. There's a few important deadlines, or I should say strategies that you will miss out on come April 15th if you don't do it now. So there, even with an extension, you will lose out on these. So the first one I want to talk about just quickly, is the health savings account. Now, over the last few weeks, you've heard me talk about this. I went in myself into the bank last week and funded my HSA and then moved the money back into my personal account to reimburse myself for all my medical last year. So I just got a write-off for last year's medical by funding my HSA. Now, last year, any of you out there that have had my class, read my book, my workshops, you know, this is a big topic. So I'll just, you know, of course, briefly say again, you've got to have a high deductible health care plan and a health savings account set up last year, but you can fund it now before April 15th. That's it. If you don't fund it by next week, you can't get a write-off for 2012. And so even if you file an extension, so that's deadline number one. Number two is your children's Coverdell IRA. If some of you are wanting to self-direct a college IRA for your kids, you can put up to $2,000. Grandma can, anybody can. There's no earned income issue. You can do this for grandkids or any minor. If you want to start a Coverdell IRA, they call them, that's C as in Charlie, Coverdell, D-E-L-L, Coverdell IRA. You can do those before April 15th and put in $2,000 as part of your 2012 contribution. And then after the 15th, you're done. You can't do it. Any contribution would go towards 2013. Now, you don't get a tax write-off for that contribution, but that money's there, and you can self-direct it. You can lend it. I bet you we're going to hear from Bruce Norse here shortly that's going to tell us how incredible it would be to self-direct a Coverdell IRA for your kids. So be thinking about that. So that's out there. Third point, the IRA or SEP strategy. Now, I just had a meeting yesterday for an hour and a half with a client going through a diagram of which strategy fit them best. And I've got to summarize this up with two words, sweet spot. There's a sweet spot for your IRA, 401k, SEP strategy. Let me hit a few basic points here, and this is something you may want to, again, touch base with your tax preparer in the next week and a half if it's urgent. Number one, if you've only got a few thousand dollars to set aside and you're not participating in a plan at work, just do a basic IRA. You may even want to do a Roth IRA if you can afford to do it after tax. Just do a basic IRA. Put in $3,000, $4,000, $5,000, nothing phenomenal. That's just a basic IRA. If you have a plan at work, that there's some matching going on at work and they provide a plan, then that's where the IRS wants you to play. So skip the IRA and just play in the plan at work. That's cool. But here's the deal. If you don't contribute to an IRA before April 15th, you're done. You cannot wait until October. You're done. So your IRA contribution has to be by next week. But if you have a small business, you can do what's called the SEP, Self-Employed Pension Plan. Now, with the SEP, you can do up to 25% of your self-employment income. And even if you have an S-Corp going on, we might be able to integrate a SEP into it. So a SEP is something that you can do if you file an extension. So let me be clear about this. If for those of you out there that own small businesses, many of our clients, we have over 50% of our clients file an extension because they're small business owners. We're not a sweatshop, Liberty Tax, H&R Block at the corner where everybody's dying to do their W-2 before April 15th. The far, far majority of our clients are small business owners that need extra time. So we're used to this. So file an extension, and you can do a SEP up until you file your return by October 15th if you have self-employment income. So skip the IRA. Don't worry about the IRA. You can always do a SEP later. So those are some of the critical April 15th points I wanted to make. And file an extension. There's a little video on my newsletter today that some of you may have already watched. Little video, if you go to my YouTube channel, I've launched a new YouTube channel that's just exclusive to my little videos this year, and I'm trying to produce two-minute tax tips or legal tips every week. And right now I'm focusing on tax tips because it's tax time, but I'll be doing more and more legal tips as well. So remember, April 15th, big deal. We've got a few strategies that you could lose out on if you don't take advantage of them by the deadline. So just keep that in mind. Now, I want to now take just a moment to introduce our expert for the show. I'm really excited to have our special guest, Bruce Norse, join us. This is an honor for me. We oftentimes speak at different events around the country and especially Southern California kind of follow each other. People say, oh, Bruce was just here last week, or Bruce is coming next week, whatever. So he's really sought after. He fills the room usually more than me, and he's, you know, just extremely bright. So I'm grateful to have him with the show now. If you haven't heard of Bruce, he is renowned for his ability to forecast long-term real estate. He wrote the California Comeback Report in 1997 that gained him much notoriety because of its accuracy and its extensive report. And that kind of set the stage for now 30 years of experience and over 2,000 real estate transactions. He's got an award-winning real estate radio show and podcast himself. He's had guests from all over the country on that. He's contributed to articles on Wall Street Journal and Business News and New York Times, all over the place. And his live events and seminars are calendared out for weeks and months in advance. So many of you I know have heard of him, and some of you may have a question for him today. So this is your chance here on the show. If you have a question for him, we'd love to have you type that in on the chat window. I'll check my emails here regularly during the show. If you have an email question, you can email me mark@markjkohler.com. But without any further ado, I want to welcome Bruce to the show. Bruce, thanks for finding some time to be with us.
Mark, thank you for the invitation. I really appreciate it.
Well, you bet. I mean, this is exciting. you and I should talk more, so it's kind of funny we end up here on radio together.
That's right. Well, so, I might mention I've got an hour of your time set aside for myself for some planning tomorrow, so that'll be a nice thing.
See, I wasn't going to disclose that unless you did, so I'm honored. so, you know, folks, look at this. Even Bruce is doing his last, you know, year in tax planning here before, or maybe for the new year. We'll see. But, Bruce, thanks so much for your trust and confidence. I appreciate that.
Sure.
Boy, I think that, you know, we certainly have so many topics that I'd like to get into. I've had clients ask me, why haven't you had Bruce on the show? And so I've kind of got a laundry list here. But I think one of just the basic questions that for our people that don't know you, I just want to ask a little touchy-feely question here right off the bat. What got you started in real estate? Was it family or a little transaction in college? Or what got the bug?
You know, it's just when I got married very young at 17, and we struggled to get enough money up for a down payment on a house. And then we just happened to get lucky. We bought our first home in the 70s, and then prices moved very quickly. And when I sold the home with my wife, we ended up getting a check for nearly $10,000, which was pretty much what I made in a year at that time. And I remember thinking, holy mackerel. What if I had owned three of these things? And that was where my mind went. So we took that money and bought three houses instead of one. And then I really didn't do anything for a while. I got a chance to work for a company in 1981 that was in the home buying business. I went to work for them on commission, and in 3 months made 3 years' worth of salary. And that was pretty much the beginning of a whole change of direction for me.
Wow. Now, what kind of real estate deals do you like? I mean, do you have your hands on a lot of different types of real estate projects, or do you lean towards rentals or rehabs and fix and flips or lending?
You know, personally, we have rentals, but the main business is a buy-sell business. We go through about 120 to 150 houses a year where we buy them, fix them, and resell them. How we find the properties varies depending on what economy we're in. So 3 years ago, we were buying REOs. Last 2 years, we're probably buying most of it at trustee sales. Now we're buying short sales and looking to maybe do some building. So the business changes constantly. We've also taught a lot of people the business, and so we put up money for other investors every month, and we do a lot of it. So this year, we'll probably fund somewhere in the range of $50 or $60 million of hard money.
Wow. Now, and I know your team does a fantastic job. I've met with many of customer that's worked with you and never, ever heard a bad word. And so we know your reputation's impeccable. But tell us about the forecast. What do you see in the future? Now, I guess, and of course, this varies from region of the country to region. So
You know, the one thing we don't do is we don't go out of our area of expertise. So I'm going to say that we're good at predicting California. So any of the any of the report titles that you mentioned all were for California. In 97, we did write a report called The California Comeback. So that was after 6 years of not so good real estate. The title was Why Real Estate Prices Will Double in the Next 8 Years. And that really came about from a bad experience of my own. I went to build a project out in 1989, and that was exactly the wrong timing. I got done with it in June of 90 and wouldn't sell a thing, so I had to hold those for 2 or 3 years and trade them for, you know, boats and all kinds of stuff just to get out of them. And then in 1995, my son Aaron graduated from high school, and I bought him a car. It was a Honda Civic that cost $15,700, and the only reason I remember it is because the next day I bought a three-bedroom house in Riverside for $13,300. And that event scared me because I realized that real estate had fallen from the sky. In 1989, real estate was thought to be no danger at all, and then 95, no one wanted it. And I really started thinking, okay, why do we have these swings, and are they predictable? Because it would sure make me feel a lot better if I had a grasp on that. So that was the beginning of an 18-month journey of studying what matters for real estate prices. And then in 06, we wrote a report called The California Crash, and basically laying out why this is about to go down a lot. And so that's how we got the reputation for being pretty accurate.
Well, with listeners of ours all over the country, maybe you could get out of your comfort zone a little bit, or at least tell us what are some of the indicators you do look at, though. I mean, no matter if a client of ours is looking at Memphis, Tennessee, or Miami, Florida, or Chicago, Illinois, what are some of the things that you think are key indicators that you've learned over the years?
Well, I look for migration. But to be honest with you, this time it's different because there's so much manipulation by government policy that California is having a comeback for different reasons, and one of the main ones is there's very little for sale. So inventory levels are important. So if I was going to be looking at what I thought was going to happen to an area, I'd be looking at their inventory levels compared to historical levels. And to be honest with you, looking at a chart that's 2 years old is not really beneficial. When we go back and look at data, we're back into the 1970 era on, so that's a 40 plus years at this point, and you start to see trends, and you start to see trends combining with other charts. So interest rates would be one of those things that people would have a misconception on. Interest rates are at what we consider historic lows, and some people think when interest rates go back up, well, that'll be very damaging to price. And that's not necessarily true, because our history, if you look backwards, mid-70s, interest rates were, say, 7.5. By 1980, they were 15. So you think, okay, well, if interest rates going up were damaged prices, then that would have certainly done it. And yet prices tripled in California during that journey. So it isn't just dependent on interest rates, and I guess that's what makes predicting real estate trends most entertaining, is that it's not always what you think.
Well, as you're saying, talking about all this data, for the average investor out there, you know, that's listening to this, it can sound daunting. I suspect the web has helped you out dramatically in the last few years, where you can get access to a lot of this data very quickly. Is that helped you?
It's helped me a great deal. It's not necessarily... You know what's great about it is if you put TDF behind any subject you want, you can find a report, and that's kind of nice. So that's what I do. I mean, honestly, I took a week off in Maui, and literally all I did was bring 50 pounds of reports and read them. Isn't that exciting?
Yeah, I don't know if that would help my Maui trip or ruin it.
It's just, you know, you said a kind of an important thing. I wouldn't want to be an average investor. It doesn't pay well, because an average investor doesn't know how to make independent decisions. So I think that's one of the things that's important, is that when we teach what we do, as we speak, we teach the methodology, not just the result. I don't want anybody leaving the room saying, well, Bruce said this stuff's going to go up, so I'm going to do this. I want them to understand the process that I went through, and I want them to disagree with it. I want them to tear it apart and do it on their own and see if they can come up with a better answer. But it's important to me that they realize that this is what why I'm investing the way I am, because these are the conclusions, and this is the process to those conclusions.
I like it. And that's a great point, because, again, because your recommendations are going to change from workshop to workshop or seminar to seminar, and people just can't show up and go, oh, this is what he said to do now, and then 6 months later, that's going to change. So
What's interesting is how quickly people make decisions based on something that, and I'm, you know, you're a fantastic speaker, and yet I know that you would feel uncomfortable with someone coming up to you and saying, okay, so based on whatever it was, 45-minute talk, they're going to switch their entire life around because Mark said so. I've had people come up to me in, say, 2005 or 6, and literally hear me for 40 minutes and come up and say, so I need to sell everything I own. And you go, well, first of all, you don't even know me. Why would you even put that much credibility in something that I just said? That's not how you make good decisions. Go, you know, take this stuff home and tear it apart. But the investors do that. Average investors do that. They take too much advice and not enough. They don't take time enough to become knowledgeable. And I think that's a real important step.
How do you I like that. And let's focus in on that for just a moment. For my listeners out there, how does one go from being an average investor to being is successful the right word, or above average? I guess you'd say usually above average, but what are some of those characteristics?
I think you have to become independently capable of making your own decisions. And then, I guess, take responsibility for the outcome. That's the hard part. You know, when you say, okay, I have looked at everything. I now think, let's say, real estate prices are going to go up. By the way, when you make a report that's worth anything, it has to be before it happens. So in 97, saying prices are going to double, I mean, I can tell you I stood in front of a lot of audiences that were really glad that I showed up because somebody was finally saying something happy. But they probably also thought I had a screw loose because it wasn't happening then. And that's when you're in the prediction business, you have to say what's inevitably going to come, not what is. So in 2006, the same thing. I stood up and talked about a crash in the midst of euphoria. That was a little hard for the audience to take, and for people that didn't know me, actually it was very upsetting because that meant discomfort in other decisions. And yet I'm looking at charts going, this is going to be a very painful crash because we've overdone it. So I guess that's one of the most important things, is to be able to rely on your own process and say, okay, I'm making this decision for my family because I feel that the odds are heavily that I'm making the correct decision. And when you make the decision, it's a lot better than reading something in Money Magazine or Wall Street Journal and saying, okay, well, this guy says this. Well, what if that person has an agenda for where you spend your dough?
Yeah, very good. Well, let's switch gears here for a minute, and that's one of the things you're famous for is hard money. I know you fund a lot of deals, but you also help many people find places to place hard money, and also teach how to do hard money. Let's talk about that for a minute. What do you see the pros and cons of hard money lending versus actually owning property? I have some clients that stay away from one or the other, maybe do a little of both, but rather than say one's good or bad, what do you see the pros and cons of hard money lending are?
Well, actually, I do both myself, so I have a portfolio of rentals and I have a portfolio of trust deeds. Trust deeds are boring. that's the part that keeps there's nobody calls and says, my plumbing broke. I'll give you an example. This is a perfect example. I was on a cruise, came back. I had basically a tornado hit an area that I own a home in, and it wasn't a tornado. It was a high wind for California. But it took out 200 feet of fence. And, of course, I got the privilege of fixing it because that was a rental I owned. Had I had the trust deed on that property, I would never have heard a thing. I would have just got my check. And so there's part of my life that's on automatic pilot. I show up home after a vacation and checks are in the mail, and that's it, the end of that. And they've been in the mail ever since I made the loan. And if hard money loans are made to the right client, and the right client is usually an investor that considers you their business partner, and they are going and doing ongoing projects, and they want to borrow money again and again and again, that's really our target borrower, then those people make the payments because they want access to other money. So it's really completely boring, but the yield is less probably than if you owned a property, especially during a California price run. So a trustee might pay 9% and cause you no grief. Owning a property could certainly exceed 20%, but you'll have those moments of excitement and, you know, vacant and eviction and work and sale and escrows and all that stuff. So a blended portfolio works for me. Some people want to reach out and get all the yield they can, so they just have the properties, and some people are in a position where they don't want any of the excitement, and they have completely forgotten about ownership of the property and just live on the interest and trust deeds, and they really don't participate in a thing other than signing the back of the check.
So, and to say it another way, I mean, this boring concept is actually can be a sense of security. It can be less headaches, but then, of course, you give it up on the rate of return. Not that hard money is a terrible rate of return. It oftentimes exceeds Wall Street by far.
Well, and the risk of principal loss is it would be hard to conceive in the next 5 years of a trust-deed investment that would produce a principal loss if it was intelligently placed. You have a borrower that has money into it. You're loaning at 65% of current value, and current value is probably going to be not the future value. It's going to go up in value, so that loan to value would be less and less as time goes by. So I just don't see the principal risk, whereas the stock market, you know, we could have some foreign country make a decision and the stock market could go down 500 points. I've been on cruises where people are eating dinner, and I could tell by their reaction at dinner that they don't have trust deeds.
There you go. Now, okay, so for the person that's thinking about getting into hard money lending, probably the level of expertise doesn't have to be as great as a real estate investor. I mean, you need to follow some procedures. Is that a misconception that you need to have a procedure for when you do trust deeds, but you don't have to be a genius or work as hard to know all the tricks and of the trade if you're not doing regular real estate? Would you agree or?
No, actually I disagree, because we see the errors that people make when they invest their own money. First of all, there's no advantage of investing your own money. So if somebody wanted to become their own hard money broker, if you will. In other words, okay, I have $1 million, but I don't want to place it with a broker. I'm going to go ahead and place it myself. There's no advantage to it, because oddly enough, the way the rules are written, you can't loan your money at a high interest rate because it's usury, where a broker doesn't have those problems. Plus, a broker, if they've been around a long time, we have, let's say, 10 people a week call us that we already know are approved, that want to borrow money, and we know the people that put up the money are going to get paid back. When you're starting, there are so many pitfalls. So we have seen so many people think that they can do it, and then they end up owning the property, and the property becomes a nightmare. Honestly, I just think it's an art, and I don't do it nearly as well as the underwriter that we have at the Norse Group. I mean, he's just got some type of antenna for when not to do a loan. So it's been very interesting listening to him talk to people. Somebody asked me, kind of about, you know, my ability in the hard money loan business. And I say, I've sat next to Craig for 15 years. I know how to answer every question exactly as Craig would. The difference is Craig knows why that's the answer. And what that means is he's got the experience. When somebody talks to me about why I think a chart means this or that, it's because I've sat there for hours and hours and hours looking at charts without agenda, trying to figure out what's next. Just to give you an example of how far we'll go on that, by the way, Sean O'Toole, who owns Foreclosure Radar, he and I went to Washington, D.C. and did some research because we were interested in seeing how low these interest rates were compared to anything in our lifetime. So we went to the Library of Congress for 3 days and looked at microfiche and looking at newspapers from 1850 on just to see when where interest rates were. But see, that's when you know something for sure, is when you did the research. Well, the hard money loan business is actually, you need a background in it, because it's not just about the person borrowing. It's about the property. It's about, are you looking at a fixer-upper? Or are you looking at a teardown? A lot of things come into it.
Folks, if you've just joined us here, we're talking with Bruce Norris, forecast expert for California, as he pointed out, and a real estate expert and investor, and hard money lender. He's done thousands of hard money loans and helps clients do the same. If you have a question for Bruce, you can call us today at 646-200-4285, 646-200-4285. Or you can send me an email, or if you're listening online live right now, there's a chat window, and you can type in a quick question. I had a question via email right here that just popped up right when you brought up the topic of a broker. The question is from Alex. He says, Mr. Norris, are you saying that I should always use a broker when I do my hard money loans? Or and then he kind of goes on a little bit and says something about not trying to do them independently. Is that...
That's absolutely true. You either are going to get paid less interest and stay within the guidelines of usury, or you're going to try and make as much interest as you could with a broker, thinking, okay, well, I'm going to charge points and interest, and that way I'll make a greater yield. And then you're going to commit usury, and somebody borrowing money that understands that's just happened has a lot of leverage they could use on you, and you can definitely get damaged that way. The other thing is, Alex, you probably aren't thinking about the time involved in saying no to five people for every yes. So when I say 10 people are funded a week here, probably another five times that are told no. Inexperience will say yes to most of those five.
Oh, okay.
And there's your problem.
So if I want to get in the hard money lending business, first of all, I'm hearing from you, align yourself with a broker that has experience and industry knowledge on loans and can help you place your money properly.
Correct.
And even though you're paying a broker, you're going to ultimately,
no,
in the long run, make more money.
Oddly enough, you don't pay a broker a thing. So on the hard money side, what happens is the only fee that we collect is servicing. So if we make a 9.9% loan, the investor gets 9%, but there's no points paid to the person that has the money, just a service fee that we collect for the placement or the payment as it comes in each month. The person that pays the fees and the points is the borrower.
Ah, okay, I see it. So as an investor, that's phenomenal. I love it.
Yeah, there's just literally, there's not a cost to it.
One of the questions that I had from a client that wanted me to bring this up with you, and I even alluded to it in my introductory comments to the show today, was self-directing IRAs, 401ks, which I know you're very astute with. The question that I had clients ask was how little money can you start with, or how much money do you have to start with? I guess you could ask it two different ways.
Well, Mark, actually, I'm going to assess up and say I'm not an expert at this, but I can tell you that I've done some talks with somebody that is, and I've heard them speak enough to where I know that it's an extremely valuable tool, and I do have a Roth IRA. And I do own trust deeds and real estate in it. The problem with having just a little money in it is that when you're borrowing money to accomplish a purchase of some kind, that it has to be non-recourse debt. And I know that's not the easiest debt to get. So that's one of the difficulties in using leverage. And there's also some tax ramifications. But you do have the ability to get an option on a property inside of an IRA vehicle. And go ahead.
Well, let me just interject. So say I'm an investor, not a borrower. So if I'm a borrower doing deals and I need hard money, I'm oftentimes going to have to provide a personal guarantee. And so I know that doing deals inside my IRA or 401k or Roth is going to be a challenge sometimes if I have to provide a personal guarantee, because it has to be non-recourse loans. But let's say I'm an investor, or I'm a person with $500,000 in an IRA or a 401k, and I want to go out and do deals hard money lending, I should say, hard money.
Okay.
I can place that money with you, and my IRA and 401k off and running. Boom.
That's correct.
But how much money do I have to get started? Do I really need to pool together several IRAs and 401ks and family? I talked about at the beginning of the show, let's get all your kids' covered LIRAs funded. Then I could form an LLC with my kids' IRAs, my 401k. But what's the minimum amount? Like, if I showed up at your doorstep tomorrow, you're going to say, Mark, you got to have at least 100 grand before I'm gonna be able to place your money.
That's probably the right number, but there's also been very recent government intervention in who can invest in this trust deed. So this trust deed of 100 grand can only represent 10% of your net worth.
Oh, okay. So really? Wow. Tell us about that. Is that I apologize.
Yeah, that's okay.
I don't work in every day.
No, believe me, that's a big change, and it's changed a lot of people. It's going to definitely make the number of hard money lenders shrink, because this is a new mandate. It's just it's almost like you have a Wall Street firm. Somebody comes in and says, I want to invest in a trust deed. I have $200,000. And then you sit down with them and you feel, okay, that would be great. And then they have a net worth of $400,000. You literally have to tell them, the biggest loan I can put you in is $40,000. And we don't pool money. So basically what ends up happening is since we don't pool money, I can't say that I know exactly how that works, but pooling that person into other trust deeds with other people is probably going to happen. He's not going to get a $40,000 first trust deed. He's going to get a third interest in a $120,000 trust deed along with two other people. That is a big change.
Now, is this new federal legislation or state?
Yes. This all came down from Dodd-Frank and the new Consumer Protection Agency.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so this is all new stuff. We just attended a seminar probably not a month ago, got the form that we literally were instructed to have every investor that invests in a trust deed fill out before they can buy a trust deed. And we were assured that there would be a government inspection on our premises at some point, that we were, in fact, following that rule.
Wow. And, of course, the old loans that are already in place are grandfathered in, but anyone new, I would presume, this is where this rule is applying.
Right. So, you know, the problem is it's really redirecting where capital has a chance to go. So let's say that somebody's
it's taken money away from Main Street again. It's Wall
yes.
Street trying to control the little guy.
Yeah. Just think about somebody that has $400,000, and for 15 years we've been providing them about $3,500 a month successfully. Well, all of a sudden that they get a 100 grand payoff, and I can't invest that in a 100 grand trust deed anymore, even though they understand trust deeds. That's part of – there's a word called suitability. So is this – investment suitable for this person? And they literally have to fill out this form and tell us not only what they're worth, what do they understand? Where's their investment background? Do they have an education? It's pretty intrusive. It really is. How much do you make? How much are you worth? What investments do you have? Why are you doing this investment? Do you have cash reserves? Is it for on and on? It's an amazing form, and you just, when you have existing clients that haven't had to do this, they really are kind of taken aback at first. They're going, my goodness. And then you have to make them realize, this is coming from my company. This is the new mandate. If you want to invest in a trustee, this is basically big government showing up in our industry.
Well, now, is this a requirement for you as a broker for placing money? Now, if I went out and did a private loan, I can take my $400,000 and do it?
No, I think that'll be a good question, and it's out of the range of what I know. But I would say whoever placed that money would have a problem or could have a problem.
Even if you're placing your own money.
Well, placing your own money, that's that's a good question. I don't know the answer to. It's all brand new.
But then again, that opens up the concerns of what you brought up earlier, that if you're now out, now they're throwing you to the wolves saying, well, Bruce can't invest my money, so I've got to go out and find my own trustees.
I think what they want you to do is find something that they want your money to go into other than this. Doesn't that seem like that? Yeah.
Yeah, let me guess. Two words, Wall Street.
Exactly.
So, yeah, just give us your money and we'll invest it for you. You Americans, you are idiots. We'll, us big banks want your money.
Trust us. We'll do you a good job.
I think the older I get, the more I sound like a conspiracy theorist. It drives me crazy. And
well, up until recently, I would have thought, yeah, you probably have, you're going too far. In the last couple of years, I'm thinking I haven't gone far enough. There's a document I'm always reading. And remember the last week where Cyprus did its thing on the people that had large deposits?
Yeah.
There's an 18-page report that was co-authored by the FDIC and the Bank of England. And in that report, that playbook is played out. That the way we end up having no taxpayer dollars pay for a banking crisis is we take the money that's been deposited over the minimum, they share in a percentage of the loss, and the rest of the money funds and gives them bank stock for the new venture. I'll send you a copy of it. It's quite illuminating.
Oh, man, this is going to turn into a doomsday radio show if we don't I'm not blaming you for that. It's just too bad. You know, it's like this last weekend I took my son down to the shooting range to shoot guns. And, boy, we had to go through a body cavity search, I felt, to, like, a lane and shoot a gun. And it's just it's crazy, and it's a crazy world. You know, government – a lot of legislators have good intentions, but there's a lot of lobbyists out there that want to put our money somewhere than we want to put it. So it's too bad. So this is enlightening. Oh, go ahead, Bruce.
No, I think that's why I still like real estate and trustees. There's still some things within my power, and if I have knowledge in it, I can do a superior job than turning my money over to somebody else. It kind of gets away from being average again. I'm a very average investor in most investments, and not an average investor in what I know best.
Yeah, no, good point. Well, we have a question here on the chat line I want to hit here too. It's not off topic. It's related to hard money. I'm going to rephrase Ray's question here. Ray says, Ray, allow me to rephrase this a little bit. He says, essentially, who gets the depreciation expense in a hard money deal? Does the investor that's securing the property get that write-off? So I guess since I'm kind of the tax guy, I'll take the first stab at this, Bruce, and then I'd love to have your feedback too. But
sure.
so anyway, Ray, essentially, the person that has the equitable interest in the property, the owner of the property, is going to be the one that gets to take the depreciation, presuming that it's a rental and a long-term hold. A lot of people that do hard money deals may be in there for just a short period of time. They're borrowing money, giving a first trustee to an investor, and then they're going to tear it down, build it up, and sell it. It may not even take depreciation. But the person that's entitled to it, if the deal allows for it, is going to be the owner of the property. The investor doing the loan, getting a first trustee as collateral, they're just going to be able to collect interest, which is wonderful, tax preferred, in a lot of ways, no self-employment tax, but there's no depreciation write-off. Anything you want to add to that, Bruce, too, from a tax perspective, as you see clients looking for the most tax advantageous investment, too?
Well, first of all, I completely agree with everything you said. And one of the things, like we were just kind of talking about, is that sometimes new rules change what people do with money. One of the interesting niches that you have in real estate is you're able to own a really fabulous residence and sell it in 2 years and make $500,000 of tax-free money if you're a couple. And I find that an interesting niche that still survived, and I think people are going to go, well, if that's what they forced us to do, that's what we're going to do.
Yeah,
you're going to
see
a lot of pressure on really cool real estate for that reason.
Yeah, and I felt enlightened to say this too, Bruce, as you're sharing the limitations an investor may have on how much money they can have in hard money. So let me rephrase that. So if you're
per loan. Yeah. So you could have a $400,000 net worth and only be able to do $40,000 per loan. But then the question would be, and there's no guidelines, is it suitable for somebody that has $400,000 to have it all in trust deeds? The answer would be no. But there's no answer to how much.
Oh, that's a great point. So I wanted to provide this clarity. This is wonderful. So with this new legislation, I can the limitation is not on how much of my portfolio can be in hard money. Just the size of each loan is limited by 10% of my net worth.
That's correct.
Perfect. So I said that. You said it. I just said it a different way. But the beauty of this too is it does in some ways encourage a person to be a little more diverse in their portfolio as well, which you constantly speak about. People should, and I do too. I mean, everybody knows that listens to me. I'd like my clients to buy one rental property a year, do a tax lien, do a hard money, or do a first trust deed. You do want your clients to be diverse. So it's not a bad thing in some ways.
You know, it's interesting. I have a different take on diversity, I have to say, okay? And it's
okay.
Partly because of my personality. I found out when I own stocks, I look at what's going on all the time. It drives me nuts.
Mm-hmm.
And I realize I don't even enjoy that investment. I don't know how to control the environment. I don't know how to make it come out okay if it goes bad, which I do real estate. So, you know, I guess for me, I have most of my eggs in the same basket. I just know how to watch that basket really well. And the other people, they are very diverse. Well, you're going to find out tomorrow how undiverse I am.
No, that's true. Because being too diverse can spread your knowledge base too thin. And that's a great point. There's a balance.
Yeah.
And here, I've got another email question I want to get to quickly before we have to wrap up here. A real compliment here from Sanan, saying, great to hear Bruce on the call when he speaks. All the real estate investors listen. And can you share the report on Cyprus with us, Bruce? Is that on your website, or how do we get a hold of this little – and many people don't know what happened in Cyprus, I think, where the government tried to make up for problems by – folks, but where could we get that just quickly?
It's a good question. You know what? Since they know us, well, here it is. I was just wondering if I still had it with me. It's called Resolving Globally Active, Systemically Important Financial Institutions. It was written December 10th, 2012, and the subtitle is a joint paper by the FDIC and the Bank of England.
Okay. Are you going to be why don't you repeat that one last time, and then also give us your website and some contact info for people that want to get in touch with you, Bruce.
Okay. It's the title again, Resolving Globally Active, Systemically Important Financial Institutions, a joint paper by the FDIC and the Bank of England, December 10th, 2012. Our website, www.thenorrisgroup.com. THENORRIS group.com, and lots of information there about trust deed investing and our upcoming talks that we have planned.
Well, I love it. And guys, I wanted to say to please get to Bruce's website. There's so much information there. And Bruce, thanks for joining us. You're awesome. I really appreciate you being here.
Mark, it was great fun. Thank you.
Thank you. Folks, we'll see you next week on Tuesday at 11 a.m. For another round of the Mark Kohler Show.
Thanks for listening to another hour of refreshing strategies to better live your American dream.
Don't forget to get your free copy of Mark and Matt's ebooks and sign up for their weekly free newsletter with important tax deadlines and articles at refreshyourwealth.com.